Welcome to Holden Village. Today in the fabulous fireside room, the speaker is David Lund, and he will be speaking about Judaism, the challenge for Christians. So, let's listen in on David.
This is the fifth session of A Course on Judaism, and the loyal remnant, the faithful remnant, are here. All four of us. As you notice in the outline, I covered it in the 4 days, pretty much all the information that I wanted to give. I was hoping that more people would be able to come and be here today, and because I'd like today to be more of a discussion. The first day I talked about God and the revolution of monotheism and ethical monotheism that Israel brought to the world, and has continued to make known to the world for 4,000 years. And the second day we talked about Torah and the purpose of Torah or law, but as I said, Torah means teacher. It doesn't mean law in the modern sense. We talked about the goals of it, the four different kinds of Torah laws: reflexive, ethical, holiness, and national laws. Then we took two examples of large complexes of commandments, statutes, and ordinances that deal with the Sabbath and then with kashrut or dietary law. And we looked and saw how those areas of law encompass all four areas. Every commandment or Torah statute or ordinance falls in at least two out of the four categories. But the Sabbath laws and the dietary laws fall under all four in many different ways. Go ahead and grab an outline if you want. Yesterday we talked about, no, the third day we talked about Israel. Mm-hmm. We talked about the Israel as a people, and then, you know, the kind of the mystical sense of Israel as a people in exile anywhere. Why don't you sit around the inner circle, because there's probably, we're not going to be so numerous today. Israel as a people, and then Israel as a state. And I talked about the two Judaisms of the late 20th century, namely Judaism of the Torah, what you might call religious or spiritual Judaism. And then I talked about Judaism of Holocaust and redemption, which is a secular Judaism with no reference whatever to God. It's a secular and a political Judaism that, of course, is a response to anti-Semitism and the Holocaust in particular, and then in response to the redemption, so to speak, of the founding of the Jewish state in 1948. And we reflected on how, for a long time, those two Judaisms have been separate in many ways. Religious Jews were not real crazy about Israel. In fact, Orthodox Jews in the beginning were very anti-Israel. They believed that it was an absolute abomination and sin for people to create a state of Israel. They believed that Israel was to wait until God intervened and the Messianic age came and when Israel would be restored. But that's changing over time. Israel is becoming more religious. Religious Jews in Israel are becoming more active and participating in the affairs of the state. For 30 years, Israel was ruled by secular socialists, no longer true necessarily, although Labor Party is back in power after quite a few years of Likud. And it goes the other way too. Not only are the secular Israelis becoming more religious, as are Jews everywhere, including North America, the religious are becoming more interested in Israel, and less anti-Israel, and less hostile toward the state of Israel as time goes by. So those two Judaisms are kind of getting fuzzy.
Is the Judaism quite a bit different now than it was in the New Testament times?
Absolutely. The Judaism that existed in the New Testament times in Jerusalem died, ceased to exist altogether. Only the Judaism of exile remain. Judaism that could adapt to the situation of being in exile, being in widely diverse cultures and times. So anyway, that it remains to be seen what the 21st century will bring, whether Israel will become more rooted in religious Judaism or not, and whether the religious Jews throughout the world will become more, feel a stronger connection to Israel. But I wanted at least you to have that historical view of how it really was secular atheist Jews who founded Israel who said, we reject religious Judaism. Because the religious Jews, you're going to eat and you're going to eat the Sabbath table and you're going to pray and you're going to go to synagogue until you either die off or are killed off.
I still have a question with that. And I mean, I'm certainly not as well informed about all this as I'd want to be, but I really believe that the first Zionists didn't necessarily walk away from God. In my opinion, they still had God. They rejected the part of their laws as far as bearing arms and killing, and that was against Torah. But they were still fighting for the people. And I think a lot of those original Zionists, the ones that are becoming more Zionists, still have God.
Okay, what generation of Zionists are you talking about? Talking about 1897, or are you talking about 1930s?
Well,
or
the Hitler's, you know, going to Israel and fighting for the people.
Okay. Well, the original Zionist movement at the end, very end of the 19th century was very secular. It was part of the Central European, socialism, rejection of religion as a worldview, materialism, not lack of belief in transcendent reality, only in material reality.
This was 19th century?
Yeah,
okay.
At the origin.
Okay.
And in the earliest 20th century, there weren't very many Zionists at all. See, that's what you need to understand, that until the Holocaust happened, there were very few Zionists. They were radicals. It was rooted in the labor movement, the labor union movement, and in all the socialist movements of Central Europe. It's hard for us to understand today because we're now living in a post-socialist age. That radical secular view of improving the world through atheistic socialism is pretty much gone. And we're living in that age now. Now, as a result of the Holocaust, of course, Zionism became much more widespread to different kinds of people. That is true. And Zionists in Russia, for example, in the late 40s and 50s and 60s, have gone from being secular communist to being more religious. Natan Sharansky is the most famous Zionist dissident in the Soviet Union. And when he began as a Zionist, he was utterly a non-believer. I mean, he was an atheist. And it was through his experiences in the Gulag, in the punishment cells and in prison camps, where he actually came to be a religious Jew. And he tells a very endearing story how his cellmate in one of the camps in the Gulag taught him, basically taught him Bible stories, and his cellmate was a Baptist. Baptists were also persecuted horribly in the Soviet Union. So and I would say that's sort of Soviet Zionism, dissidents type things. Although people like the most famous dissident, the scientist,
Gospel? You're not saying it's old?
No. Sakharov. Sakharov remained secularist till the end. But many, many dissident Zionists who wanted to emigrate to Israel did become more religious. And but again, that's later. That's post-Holocaust. What I want you to understand is when Zionism first appeared, people just laughed. Because at that time, most Jews throughout Europe believed, they still believed in this project of what they called Jewish emancipation. They still believed that they could work through the political structures of the countries they live in to achieve equal rights and non-discrimination and stay there and be equal citizens. Most of them still believed in that. And Herzl and the other Zionists came along and said, we abandon that project. We believe that Jew hatred is so deep, we just don't believe that it will happen. We abandon that project and instead we seek a political solution, namely a Jewish state. Now, as I said yesterday, they didn't necessarily think it would be Palestine, but they did start to say there needs to be a Jewish state. That's the only way that Jews are going to be safe. And of course, and Herzl said, and he said, in 50 years it will be so. And everybody just thought it was absurd. I mean, all politicians and Jews throughout the world thought he was a nut. 51 years later, you see, as a result of the Holocaust, everything that the Zionists said came true. That project of equal rights never materialized. In fact, anti-Semitism got worse. And wherever the Nazis went, the masses of population supported the deportation and the extermination of Jews, you know, the Poles, the Ukrainians, the Lithuanians, Russians, everywhere.
And nowhere they didn't.
Yeah, everywhere in Central Europe, though. Yeah, the notable exceptions of Nazi occupation where people did not help was in Denmark and in Norway. Denmark even more strikingly, because there were a lot of Jews in Denmark. And almost all Danish Jews got away, were either hidden or got out through the help of the population. That's true. Well, it was neutral. I mean, the Nazis couldn't do anything there. You know, Jews were living in Switzerland, and if you could get there, you could live and be well in Switzerland.
Well, they weren't having any trouble with the Swiss government there.
No, not really. Not that I know of. Of course, Austria, is more virulently anti-Semitic than Germany ever was. You know, still is. Vienna is still a very horrible place for Jew hatred. Supported by the population, Waldheim gets broad-based political support still. Anyway, we talked about that third day, and then yesterday we talked at greater length about Jew hatred or anti-Semitism, and I draw attention to the fact that it is Jew hatred, and anti-Semitism was a euphemism created in 1879 by a German who believed that it sounded more scientific and sort of more polite, less vulgar. But it's really what it is. We talked about the false reasons that many people believe in for anti-Semitism, and then we talked about the real reasons that Israel has been persecuted and picked on ever since it came into the world. And that's, of course, because of Judaism, because of the message that Israel brings about God and God's will, and other things, higher quality of Jewish life, etc. We talked a little bit about anti-Zionism, which is an anti-Zionist is a person who denies Israel's right to exist as a state. So I was very careful to say to people, to be severely critical of particular Israeli policies is not to be an anti-Zionist. You're only an anti-Zionist if you agree with those who say the Jewish state should not exist and as soon as possible should be eliminated and destroyed. That's anti-Zionism. And of course, most of us aren't real familiar with that view, but it's pretty common in the world. Fortunately, not so common in our culture. But anyway, today I'd like to just sort of kick around some of these questions. At the very end, I put questions for Christians to consider. And I'll just read through them so we can, and you can decide which ones you want to talk about. What have you learned through this course that might have changed your view of Judaism? What aspects of Judaism fit with your understanding of Christian faith and help you, and which don't? How might you go about educating yourself more deeply about Judaism? Where do you see points of contact or agreement between Judaism and Christianity? What ways might Christians and Jews work together based on commonality? Did anyone, I don't know if they're all gone yet or not, but did anyone read it in the Nine Questions, the book that's... Did you get it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
well, there's a section in there, page 78 through 91, where they give their view of Christianity. And it's very interesting to read. And what I like to do is read it and then respond as a Christian to the ways that I, you know, there's some ways where I say that's not my faith, what you're describing. But that's a good exercise. Sometimes I teach a course like that with a friend of mine who's a rabbi, and he describes Christianity. And I critique his description of it, and I describe Judaism, he critiques my description of it. And we found that to be very fruitful, because most Christians have a very strange picture of Judaism, that there's kind of a Christian view of Judaism that is kind of a fiction that Christians have made up, and then there's a Jewish view of Christianity that is pretty much a fiction that Jews have made up, you know, for various reasons. So, and then number seven, how committed is the church to ethical monotheism? How committed are you? What about intermarriage? What are some of the dynamics of intermarriage? Which Jewish practices or values would be practical or good for Christians to adopt? Where do you see Jew hatred today? Where do you see anti-Semitism? What do you do to work against it? How do you work out the relationship between Jews and Christians? And I put, people are usually passionate, rarely neutral, about the state of Israel. Why is that? And what might be a Christian understanding of the state of Israel today? And there's another question that Hans pointed out at after class last time that we really need to talk about is, what about the legacy and the history of Christian anti-Semitism? Hans Spalteholz, he had been visiting this class and also going to, what's her name, Spicer? What's her first name? Lydia Spicer's class about, you know, the war against Native Americans. And she talked about the need, if there's ever reconciliation and forgiveness to take place, there has to be some kind of confession. You know, and so Hans said, well, we need to talk about that in Jewish-Christian dialogue. We need to talk about, you know, the millions of Jews that Christians have tortured and murdered through the ages. And it's not enough just to say, well, I wasn't around then. I wasn't directly part of it. That's not enough. And that's like younger Germans when they say, well, I wasn't around. I'm not responsible. You know, I don't have anything to do with the Nazi time. Or, you know, then that's... That's not a biblical view. The biblical view is that sin hangs around, and that even subsequent generations are affected by the past. And so if that's true, then we have some things to think about as Christians. So any or all of those topics I'd like to just kick around with you today. I don't have an agenda other than if there's any topics there that you would like to engage in conversation about.
I think one of the, and I've shared this with you before, I think it's after the first couple of days, and I've talked to a few people since then, and the one thing that has really stuck with me is your comment about Judaism based on a way of life and Christianity being based on a belief. And I feel so many of us have gone away from the way of life, and Christians need to live Christianity as the Jews mm-hmm. and as our Christian faith, in my opinion, had its roots, is we're to live our faith, not just believe it. And this has mm-hmm. reconfirmed that for me.
Yeah, it's always ironic that the two great monotheistic faiths that have grown out of Judaism, Christianity and Islam, both tend to be very focused on correct belief and on acceptance of certain propositions and doctrines and so forth as almost constitutive of being Christian or being Muslim. Islam is really similar in that way. And you're right, Judaism is very different than that. It's not based in doctrine. It's not based in beliefs. One of my favorite stories is about a person who came to a rabbi and said, "Rabbi, I just can't believe in God anymore. I don't believe that God exists anymore." And the rabbi said, "That's fine, no problem. You have problems with belief about God? That's okay. So do I. But in the meantime, but you should live the life. You should live a faithful life and live an observant life, live a communal life with your people. And if your belief in God comes back someday, that's fine. But in the meantime, good will have been done. The world will have been improved." That's a very, very typical Jewish view. It's not such a big deal if everybody submits to all the same doctrines. In fact, the Talmud itself is a commentary on Scripture with different rabbis arguing and giving different interpretations. And that's how you study the Scripture in Judaism. That's how Talmud works. Disputation. And people don't necessarily agree. They do agree, however, on practice, on what it means, you know, to be faithful. And for religious Jews, of course, that means observing the Sabbath, observing kosher, giving charity, caring about your neighbors in that way. Does that frustrate you about, there's some frustration I hear in what you say about how Christians, you know, tend to see their faith as, you know, well, if I, you know, confess a certain thing and believe certain doctrines, then I'm doing what I should do.
Right. And it frustrates me in the fact that I suppose we do have the grace of Jesus who I can go out and sin and Jesus and God will forgive me. But as a Christian, and the way I want to live and the way I want my children to live, I don't want to have that feeling that I can go out and do that. I want to live my life. And if that's based on discipline and mm-hmm. and study, then in my opinion, that's the way I want to live. Mm-hmm. And I can't say that's okay for you, but...
Why not?
Because in Christianity, we're led to believe that everyone has that choice. I would like to see.
But it's a very modern idea that Christianity is not about a way of life, a very visible way of life that people share. That's a new idea that Christianity is not, you know.
Well, then I guess I'd like to see us get back to it.
And maybe it's a watered-down version to tolerate, in cults, to tolerate other religions that are not Christian. Mm-hmm.
Well, it's actually a modern thing to tolerate low involvement.
There's more validity in accepting the Jewish faith as Christians than there ever was. And I'm not sure where I stand on that.
Yeah.
Particularly, I'm not a Jew hater, but I don't know how... when I was brought up, I was brought up in the 50s. I was born in 1945, and I was brought up in the church that you're the minister of now, Bethel Lutheran Church.
Oh, really?
With Carl Peterson. And it was very much so that Lutheranism was the only faith. And in confirmation, we talked about other faiths. We talked about Baptists. We talked about we would call holy rollers, so to speak, and we talked about Mormonism, Catholic Church, and there was nowhere near the cooperation between the Catholic and Lutheran Church that there is now. And we talked a little bit about Judaism too, but it was taught to us at the time that, well, the Lutheran is the only faith. And when you go looking for wives, husbands and wives, why, you ought to be very concerned about their beliefs.
This is actually a real traditional Jewish view. Mm-hmm. Jews are real concerned about intermarriage for a lot of good reasons. Mm-hmm. You had your hand up.
Oh, and there's, I kind of lost track of traditions and the things you would like to see as a Christian. What types of things are you talking about? When you talk about disciplines, are you saying rituals type things? Are you saying walking in Christ's shoes? I kind of a lot of times see some faiths going through rituals, which are neither good nor bad, but to me they're rituals. And then there's a relationship. Mm-hmm. And sometimes the relationship reflects the rituals, and sometimes the rituals have absolutely nothing to do with the relationship. So when I hear discipline sometimes I'm a little afraid it gets to be a work type thing that you go through that but that type of relationship.
What are the classical?
And I don't know
what are the classical Christian.
And I don't think you are, but no, that's sometimes that's, when I hear people say, "Oh, we don't have them anymore." I just thought, I don't know what the relationship is.
Okay, what are the classical Christian disciplines?
Prayer.
Worship.
Worship through the day, not just once a week. Yeah. Sabbath keeping. Study. Now, you call those rituals? Yeah. Is that what you mean when you say rituals?
I think sometimes they are, but as a rule, no. It depends on how your heart's going. But sometimes it can be very ritual. I go to church and directly up.
This is good. We're hearing a classical Christian view here, and that's good. I'm glad you're saying it.
I mean,
it's a really classical Christian view.
Sometimes it's because of the relationship, and
especially a liberal Protestant view is exactly what you're articulating. That rituals aren't worth much unless your heart is in it, and the Jewish view is exactly the opposite. You know, with the example of the story I told, basically the Jewish view is if your heart's not in it right now, fine. Do what you should do. Do the observance. You know, be obedient and faithful. And eventually, the heart will come back. But in the meantime, you will have been faithful. And good will have been done.
But are you faithful because your rituals, or be faithful because your relationship?
The Jewish view is that our actions shape our beliefs much more than our beliefs shape our actions.
Because a lot of Christian writers do suggest this, that, you know, the idea that you should feel and experience something, but that if you want to live a Christian life, that you set aside time for prayer, you set aside time for reading the Bible, you worship, you try to live a Christian life as you understand it, and even though you don't feel you're achieving anything spiritually, by those actions you are, and eventually, if you go on doing it, you're doing it because you made a commitment to do it.
And that commitment in itself is a relationship.
That's
it. I mean, it reflects.
Yeah, I'm very sympathetic to the view that our actions shape our beliefs more than our beliefs shape our actions. I believe by observation of people, I believe it's true. By looking at history, I believe it's true. And there are Christian, that is part of our Christian tradition too. It's just part that's been neglected. In the last 400 years.
Sometimes I force myself to go to church when I really don't feel like it. I just don't feel like doing anything. Mm-hmm. But when I force myself to be ritualistic or go to church and do the things, I come out with a considerably better attitude.
Okay, but
and
again,
not only church, just when I get up in the morning. Lots of people are.
But again, I'm troubled with this sense that ethical actions are ritual. It's the language that you hear. The language you're using.
Yeah.
Like for example, when I obey the commandment against adultery and I stay faithful to my wife, is that ritual? Is that ritual? So you're separating. You probably call that ethics or morality. You know.
Maybe we think of ritual as something we repeat, like the.
I repeat that. I'm faithful to my wife every day. I repeat it every day.
I have one that I think we could, and there again, it's a gift, and it's something that our Lutheran church is struggling with right now, which is
rules and regulations.
I would call
ritual.
A gift, yes, but also a ritual, and that is the gift of communion for children.
Mm-hmm.
And I know many, many Lutheran churches now are saying, yes, bring your infants forward. And my children are very much raised in faith. I'm trying.
Mm-hmm.
It's something we're learning.
Mm-hmm.
And we can go to any church and they can receive communion except our church.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a ritual, I think.
It has become.
But it's being denied to them as a gift.
And the way we've been able to get around that particular thing is my husband gives the children that wish to partake, and that's a gift that was given to them through Jesus, is the fathers had to give it to the child, which then makes the pastor not have to even deal with the congregation, the synod, anybody else. It's become our burden to give that, which I don't feel they should have to. Of course, I was raised in the Baptist.
But see, here again, it's a relatively new phenomenon in Christianity that intellectual understanding, for example, of the sacrament is so important. You know, in the early church and in the Middle Ages, it was much more the view that you don't understand it, fine, but communing regularly will create in through that their spiritual growth will occur so that you do grow in faith. In other words, doing it, you know, actions will affect you know, worship and receiving the sacrament will affect your beliefs much more than the other way around.
Yeah. See, and I've had problems with that coming from a Baptist background and going to a Lutheran church. My Baptist background gets into that part of baptizing as an infant, and then they go through confirmation, and supposedly once they know all that, then that's it.
Yeah.
Whereas as a Baptist, you're baptized when you wish to accept God's grace,
mm-hmm.
and from there on, and then you go through
mm-hmm.
your life as following or not following.
Right.
And that makes it.
I want to explore this question of ethics versus ritual for a minute. Because we tend to think of things not, like, for example, the commandments. You know, not stealing, not being adulterous, you know, not murdering.
Mm-hmm.
We tend to think, we say, well, that's ethics. But then we look at something like the sacrament or Sabbath keeping or regular worship, and it's a very Protestant response is to say, well, that's ritual. But what I want you to see is that in the Jewish view, there's no difference at all. It's all Torah.
Mm-hmm.
It's all commandments, statutes, and ordinances. Whether it's commandments about the measurements of the temple, or commandments of how to do a Passover Seder, or commandments not to kill animals, you know, with pain and suffering, or commandments against incest, or commandments, you know, of marital faithfulness. It's all Torah.
Mm-hmm.
And it all shapes people.
Right.
It all shapes people. All those actions shape people and the kind of people that they become. And there is absolutely no division. And we've put that division in there, and it's interesting how we've done that. Because, you know, on the one hand, you say, you know, or, and many people say, well, you know, regular prayer through the week, you know, Lutheran people in my church say that's too Catholic. And but at heart, what they're really saying is, well, that's ritual, and we don't need that. And somebody said, what's ritual? Repeated actions. Well, I'm tempted to steal and decide not to steal at all constantly. That's a repeated action.
I make the difference between...
It's not the same time of day.
It's not an action. It's a lack of action. You're not.
Well, all right.
It's an action.
It's an action, though. Yeah.
But I mean, it's part of my discipline.
Right. I was saying
and I don't, it doesn't happen on the clock, the same time every day, but it happens. I mean, each time you choose to obey a commandment rather than disobey, and of course, again, in the Hebrew scriptures, building the temple or... doing the celebrating the Passover is obeying commandments, just like so-called ethics. I mean, but there's no there's no difference. We've separated that out somehow.
Ritual. At some point, it can become ritual.
But what was ritual?
Yeah.
Nothing.
But
again, why is ritual any different in how it shapes us than what, you know, Ten Commandments?
I guess I just don't think God gives, I mean, this is a personal Janice statement. Uh-huh. I don't think he gives a rip how big our church is. I don't think he cares at all. That's neither Lutheran or Judaism or anything. That's just me. And I just think that's not the heart of being a, for me, a God-fearing person or putting Christ central or whatever is the size of my church. Or the washing of my hands. For a Jewish person to do that, I'm not saying that is wrong for them, but for my personal relationship, that's not how to live out a Christian life as much as, which I do hopelessly at times, helping another person, putting Christ central in my life, and that type of thing. The little daily things of washing and size of church and all that, to me, I don't think that's where the focus is. That's not, to me, that's not our mission to go out and do, is not build a church of circumcised.
Well, let me ask you this way. How many of you pray regularly if you don't pray every day? How many people are able to pray regularly but not pray every day? Or let's put it this way. Let's put it regularly, on a regular basis.
Oh, if it is.
You said not every day. Not every day.
But it you said not every day.
With some other regularity other than every day.
Well, what you mean is that it's constantly in your mind. You're constantly thinking about God, about prayer, about Christ, about Him being in your life and helping you.
But do you do that? And if you don't have a structure of discipline in your life to do that?
No. I don't. I forget.
Maybe a better way to put it would be this way.
That's a relationship.
In my, you tell me if you're like me. If I don't pray every day, you know, if I don't take time to pray every day, I tend to not do it at all. You know, twice a week, well, then I have to remember what day it is. And I'm real busy, you know. We have little kids. So what happens is, you know, I basically don't at all. Now, are you like me that way?
Yeah.
I think you used an important word there, structure. Because I think it's a question of building your life around a structure.
Right.
And which builds in those disciplines which are popular.
There's this great, you know the hymn, Dear Lord and Father of Mankind. And my favorite verse from that is, it says, till all our striving cease, take from our souls the strain and stress, and let our ordered lives confess the beauty of thy peace. And that's always meant so much to me, and especially like last week when I was teaching Genesis, the whole thing about the creation in the Bible is order. Mm-hmm. And Paul says, God is a God of order, not of chaos. Not a God of confusion, but a God of order. And that has come to mean a lot to me, you know, that sense of order and structure as a way of faithfulness. I think, well, you know, again, this is part of Jewish Christian conversation, because, you know, many Christians are finding that you know, just an acceptance of propositions or making a correct statement of belief once a week, it's just not enough. It just seems like I don't feel like I am wholly God's, you know? If it isn't a more constant, more disciplined kind of thing. And as the age of the Enlightenment kind of breaks down now, thank goodness, Christian disciplines do become something that people think about and write about and talk about more. And all of them are rooted in Judaism. I guess that's what I find interesting. You know, prayer through the day, you know, offices, even the offices of worship through the day are based in Jewish prayer. You know, matins, vespers, compline, etc.
But you're right, a routine. When I think of when we do school during the week, we have our routine, and that's when we do our Bible stories, and that's when we say our prayers. And then
the
weekend Saturday
comes. Comes,
the weekend comes, it's like, you know, well,
doesn't happen.
And then during the summer. Yeah.
That's right. That's right.
Well, we're
and,
both
and I, this is just me talking now. I think God does care if we pray.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Not
because it does.
I don't think that's the same size as
not,
the church.
Not because.
To me, they're a totally different thing. But that's okay if somebody else doesn't. I'm not going to say they're wrong in that. If they want to.
But
I
see, the problem, though.
Yeah, and it's an ambiguous line, a gray area where that separates for me. And that's.
Well, obviously, Christians aren't going to build a temple. They're not going to care about.
Well, no, a church.
Temple
if you're
commandments.
Saying, no, but I'm saying if that is something that's strong in their faith, and I have a brother-in-law that's Islam that's very structured in his.
Well, all temple commandments can't be observed anyway. Because
well,
there's no
okay,
temple.
Whatever the ones that you want to suggest, you brought it up before, I just used it as your suggestion. That I guess then that's kind of the beauty of it is to choose which ones work in your
right.
life and which ones
see, the problem. The problem with liberal Protestantism is that what we've got is since we've said, you know, works don't save, which is true. Since we've harped on that, you know, works don't save. Well, everybody has got it. You know, everybody gets that in liberal Protestantism. And so, but what happens is any kind of works get devalued, whether they're works of mercy or whether they're works of discipline or whether they're, you know, any kind of actions. And what becomes most important is right faith. And I think selfish human nature likes that and says, oh, good, I can have the right faith and I don't have to do anything. I don't have to. This isn't difficult. This is easy. I can handle this. And get. I can handle this and get into heaven too, you know. And that's our problem is then, it's not like, you know, we say that we aren't bound by commandments, you know, in a legalistic way. But for most liberal Protestants, that means we don't have to worry about any works whatsoever. We don't have to care. I'm talking to you from the view of just watching my parishioners, looking at people in the church, listening to how they interpret it, and. Now, really, what it leads to for many people is just kind of an antinomianism, where you end up not only throwing out, you know, any Old Testament codes, but you also end up throwing out like the Sermon on the Mount.
I liken it. I like
because that's commandment
some
too.
Some dysfunctional Christians, where a Jewish thing has been such a tradition, and they have their way of life and they have their rules, and basically from one generation to another generation, I'm just making a big assumption that they're not dysfunctional in their faith. Whereas you have people who have been brought up in a Christian faith, and then their families are brought up, and then you have other people who are born again. They're very dysfunctional I see that a lot in my community as far as being in a homeschool community. There's quite a few people that are dysfunctional in their faith because they have no idea on some of the behaviors, the character building of their children. because of their own dysfunction of not being brought up when they were little to adulthood. Mm-hmm. That's how I see it, as being a wide variety of dysfunctional Christians, mm-hmm, out there teaching more dysfunctional,
right,
instead of where a Jewish would be from one generation to another if they've kept their,
right,
their faith in their own life.
I think there's a conflict between Christianity and Judaism. First of all, we're from the same background. Okay, we're the same.
Yeah, definitely.
We didn't just suddenly exist 2,000 years ago. God didn't suddenly come in presence 2,000 years ago.
Right.
No, yeah.
His God, I mean, their God is our God.
That's right.
Yep.
But 2,000 years ago, somebody got off the train. Us or them. Now, is there two trains and they're both going the right direction? Or well, we give credit to that?
That's something you got to think about.
That's
exactly what you got to struggle with.
What you were saying about what you learned as a child in Sunday school. I mean, I come from a Missouri Synod Lutheran background and talk about talk about thinking you're going to be the only ones in heaven. I mean, that's sort of it. Some branches of my family are more conservative than others, and one of the more conservative branches, one of my cousins married a Jewish man. And it's been really interesting to watch the way families all of a sudden had to deal with this. You know, that as long as they're sort of those people out there, it's not a problem. It becomes a member of the family. And my aunt leaned over, I think it was Trinity Sunday, they were saying the Athanasian Creed or something. My aunt leaned over to my father in the middle of church, and there's a section at the end of the Athanasian Creed about whosoever does not believe this is not inherit the life or something like that. And she just said, I don't believe that. Because my brother-in-law was sitting right next to her. And I mean, my cousin.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's a real different story. Mm-hmm. And I think that really is, mm-hmm, something that Christians have got to think about, because it's not just the people.
And especially in dialogue with Jews, because since Judaism is not based on assent to doctrines, Judaism is much different than that way. I mean, it's very easy for non-Jews to be part of the world to come. In fact, it's much easier than for Jews. You know, you saw Schindler's List?
Mm-hmm.
And he's buried in Vod Yashem, and he's been declared a tzaddik, a Gentile, you know, a righteous Gentile, because of the good he did. You see, Jews don't shut Gentiles out of the kingdom. They talk about the seven basic commandments of the children of Noah, and they say, you know, Gentiles are God's people too. They're not the chosen people bringing the specific message, but they are God's beloved people. And there are many righteous among them. You know, Wallenberg is declared a righteous Gentile, and lots of people. And that's another thing that Jews can't understand when they hear a Christian talk about, you know, no matter how good of a person you are, if you don't believe these doctrines, you're going to hell. I mean, for Jews, that's absolutely crazy. It makes no sense that somebody would live a good life, help their neighbors, be self-sacrificing, be generous all their life, and go to hell. I mean, a Jew just goes, you got to be kidding. I mean, that's an abominable idea, you know, to them.
As a Christian, I believe the same way, though.
But that's not, but see, traditional Christianity has not said that.
No, and there are a lot of Christians in our church that feel that way. And I remember sitting at Wednesday morning Bible studies having that same conversation. What do you mean? And to me, it is so absurd that people would think that. I don't know why.
But again, we're moving out of the age where doctrine was supreme, mm-hmm, where right, correct belief was the most important thing. How many of us here are Lutherans? Mm-hmm. Okay, most of us. We're lucky you. No. The reason I say this is that we Lutherans have a particular problem, is that our whole version of Christianity was born in the university. It was born in arguments over doctrine and theology. Completely. You know, Lutherans today are arguing about worship and about, you know, morality and way of life. And that has never been part of the Lutheran thing. It's always been about doctrine and theology. It's always been real cerebral. You know, it's always been very academic. I mean, Luther was a professor. The thing was born in universities. And so we have a particular problem. And, you know, it issues forth in different ways. In the Missouri Synod, through this incredible legalism on doctrine, but in the ELC as well, over a different kind of legalism, I guess, you know. And getting the ideas just right, rather than focusing on how what shape our life together takes, and let alone what shape our personal life takes. I mean, that's a question that's just out of bounds for people who are dealing with it in such an abstract, you know, intellectual level. I mean, to ask, what I teach my children, or how I treat my spouse, or whether I vote or not. I mean, these are personal questions, you know. Don't ask me about my way of life. You know, that's none of your business. Well, that's a very odd thing, you see, for any worshipers of the biblical God to say. That's all I'm arguing. You were raising your hand.
I
don't
know. As a Jewish person, for the kingdom of God or eternal life, what is it for them to obtain that or towards that?
To be a faithful member of Israel. However they understand it.
Okay.
Really. I mean, there's not conformity that way in Judaism. See, I think that's the hardest thing for Christians to understand. Basically, when Christians think of Judaism, what they usually think of is like a Jewish church. They think of a church with Jewish doctrines instead of Christian doctrines, and etc. And that's really a mistake, because first of all, Judaism isn't even based primarily in the synagogue. It's based in the home. It's a much more behavioral day in, day out way of life. It's not even a religion in the sense that Christianity is centered on a sanctuary and in the church. It's really centered in the home. And in
I was going to ask, how many Lutheran churches have a Seder meal in Holy Week? Have the whole Jewish ritual Seder meal? We do. And I wonder if you do too.
People have talked about it, but I actually discourage it. I'd rather have them go to a synagogue or go into a Jewish home on Passover and experience it. Because, you know, for Gentiles to stand around and do a Seder meal out of a book is funny.
It's funny, but it teaches. It's a little bit of...
And Jews would be very uncomfortable with it. That's the reason I wouldn't do it, is because I know my Jewish friends would... I mean, that would really, if they knew about it, it would really bother them.
It's a part of our history, yeah. So...
But it would really bother them.
There's a couple of churches in Longview that do it.
Yeah.
One thing my church has done, as sort of as an alternative, because it is kind of weird, I think, for Christians to do a Seder, is on Maundy Thursday, to include in the words of institution some of the Jewish prayers, and we say them in Hebrew. Because
some of the Passover Haggadah. Now that I can see.
Jesus said this, yeah. And then we say it both in English and in Hebrew, and that brings home the idea that the Last Supper was a Jewish thing, you know.
But still on Maundy Thursday.
We're not practicing a Seder meal, we're practicing
Maundy Thursday, the Last Supper.
Make some of those connections.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You just
eat all
week long.
It's over here.
Kind of strange.
How about that issue I raised of, you know, just the Christian history of treatment of Jews? What are we as Christians going to do about that, if anything? Are we gonna? I mean, do we think it's over and done, and and nothing more needs to be done with it, or what?
I guess I've led such a sheltered life. I can't imagine people being prejudiced against one another and trying to raise my children just because someone looks different, someone wears different clothes, maybe they're poor, maybe they're rich. The way they've been brought up, their own beliefs, that doesn't give them the right to mistreat
sure.
or to abuse or...
Sure, but the reality of history is...
At least know that you need to study history to know what has happened in the past so it doesn't repeat itself.
Because Jews remember.
Oh, yeah. Right.
You know, the victim remembers a lot longer.
That's right.
You know, historically, our ancestors in faith... you know, again, in the name of right faith, in the name of fighting heresy and so forth, have tortured and murdered, you know, millions and millions of people.
And it wasn't just
infants included. Mm-hmm. You know, in the Crusades, whole villages were Jewish villages
Jewish history
were wiped out.
The purification of the Jewish.